The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society. The Korea Society, in 2007, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. On February 9, 2006, the Korea Society hosted a presentation titled Hungry for Peace, International Security, Humanitarian Assistance, and Social Change in North Korea by Hazel Smith. Smith is a professor of international relations at the Warwick University in the United Kingdom and a consultant to major NGOs providing relief to North Korea. Taking issue with the popular notion that North Korea's state secrecy makes accurate information on North Korean society impossible to come by, Smith argued that much information was available, and it indicates that important but largely unnoticed social changes are underway in North Korea.
Hazel is teaching at Warwick University in England, is on leave working. She, when did your book first come out?
Just before Christmas.
Hunger for Peace is for sale here. She's now doing research on North Korean shipping and various other arcane subjects. And she said, if you're really know where to look and aren't lazy, there's a tremendous amount that can be learned about North Korea, the registry of ships, where they go, who owns them. What kind of things they carry. She said North Korean shipping is sort of an open invitation to smuggling and all kinds of things because it's very poorly regulated. And so you'll hear that and a number of other things from Hazel. She has spent a lot of time in North Korea, was there during much of the really bad time in the mid-90s, and she can speak of that. How it has been ministered to by the outside world, where that has left Korea, North Korea, in terms of its accessibility, and what the prospects for transformational change may be. So please help me welcome Hazel Smith. Would you rather sit?
If you don't mind, I'll sit because I want to speak to my notes.
All right.
Is that okay?
Sure.
Because I have to think about my glasses, with changing them if I stand up.
Now, if you can't hear, put up your hand.
Okay, I'll speak into the mic.
And by the way, the music that was playing, in case any of you wondered, was by the new Korean sensation Rain. We just thought that was a little additional education for, subliminal education for all of you. Thank you.
I will stand. Is this mic on, and can you hear me now at the back? Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to Ambassador Greg, Mrs. Greg, and Fred, if he's here. I haven't seen him yet. for inviting me, and for the Korea Society for inviting me. It's it's always a pleasure to be here. The first time I came, I think, was in 2002. It's a pleasure because it's wonderful to be able to talk about, such an indulgence to be able to talk about things that you're interested in and that you've been doing some work on, but also because the feedback and the discussion is always of such high calibre and in terms of the informed nature of the people that are here. So for me, it's it keeps me on my toes. It means that I can't get away with just waffling, at least I hope I can't. And also it means that I learn a lot when I'm here, so I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to be here again. I'm going to give a short talk and try to keep it short, actually, so that we can have plenty of time for discussion on broadly speaking on the subject of the book, which is called Hungry for Peace, but the subtitle is International Security, Humanitarian Assistance and Social Change in North Korea. And I guess for most of us, or for most people in the West, certainly in Britain, but I think also in the United States, whereas we're used to thinking about international security issues in North Korea, we're used to thinking about humanitarian assistance and North Korea, we very rarely reflect on the massive social and economic change that has taken place in North Korea, in the DPRK, in the last 15 years. We very rarely indeed distinguish between government and society when we're talking about the DPRK. So we willy-nilly talk about the DPRK this and North Korea that, but we don't distinguish between the government, which makes policy and implements policy, and a society where there are different groups within it. They do different things, they relate to each other in different ways, they have different economic opportunities, they have different social opportunities, and how those things have changed over the past 15 years. So I guess it's the last of those things that may be the newest to our discussions. But that's the theme of my book, is the interrelationship of those three issues. Perhaps I'd just give some background of where I'm coming from on this issue that I've been writing about for some time now, because we all have different backgrounds and so we all address things from different perspectives. I've been working on the DPRK now for nearly 20 years, not as a specialist, I have to say. I wasn't trained in Korean studies. I wasn't trained in Asian studies. My PhD is in international relations. So I came into the subject from a security-related perspective, actually. And my first couple of books were on Nicaragua and the Sandinista Revolution. And so what I was interested in at the time when I first started looking at Nicaragua was how, at the DPRK, was how these revolutionary states, these awkward revolutionary states, how they managed to get by in the international system. How do their foreign policies change? How do their domestic policies affect their foreign policies? How do they manage to live with the major states in the system, which by definition don't agree with their interests or values or the way that they behave? I mean, this, of course, is a perennial question in political science. If you look back at Henry Kissinger's work on 19th century Europe and the balance of power, and this is one of the things that he was interested in his scholarly work, and how to keep control on all these mad revolutionaries that might be coming out of France or thereabouts. And of course, in the French Revolution, the major question for the major powers in Europe, for the empires, was how do you stop this revolutionary state expanding? How do you stop it spreading all these ideas which we simply don't agree with, equality, democracy, or equality and fraternity? And it was fraternity between men, of course, then. How do we stop it? How do we stop that? And what's going to be the relationship of the domestic politics of France to international politics? So all these issues that we saw with Sandinista Nicaragua, we've seen before. And I think that's another thing for us to remember in terms of our perspective on the DPRK. Some of the broader political science issues which we deal with, how do you negotiate as a diplomat with a state whose interests and values you do not share in order to get an agreement? But really, of course, this has always been the classic question of diplomacy. Diplomacy at its heart is about the use of peaceful means to achieve agreement with partners or adversaries whose interests and values you don't share. I mean, of course, diplomacy takes place between friends, but the heart of diplomacy is that. And I think, so these are not new questions for us, but sometimes, particularly for those of us that work on the DPRK, we get so enthralled in our little niche and what we're doing because it's so important that we forget that, you know, there are similar questions that have been asked before, both historically and in other parts of the world. So I think that that's always a good reminder for all of us who attempt to do anything on this area. So my background is this. I started to visit North Korea in 1990 as a guest of the Korean Academy of Social Scientists, something called the Juche Academy, based in Manyongdae, which was the headquarters of then Hwang Yang-yop, who I interviewed in 1991, who headed the outfit, and it was supposed to promote the Juche Academy worldwide, the Juche ideology worldwide. And actually I had a number of interesting talks with people there, people that I still see today when I go back. In 1990, 1991, and probably the most interesting visit was in 1994, just after President Kim Il Sung died, when the country was very problematic about what was going to happen, and even my North Korean colleagues weren't quite sure where things were going to go. So my background was international relations, and I was involved in the first nuclear crisis, 1993-94, as a commentator. And then, of course, it comes around again. But in between that nuclear crisis and this nuclear crisis, there was the impact of the humanitarian organisations in the DPRK. And because there were few people from outside that had ever had any chance to go in and do some analysis, I was asked to go in by UNICEF and World Food Programme and UNDP, and did a lot of work in country, worked in 11 of the 12 provinces in the DPRK throughout the whole country, working and living. And so there's a spiral of involvement there. So this has just grown. That for me, there hasn't been there wasn't ever an instance when I said, I'm going to work on the DPRK, because I didn't have I didn't study Korean, so my Korean is what I learnt in Pyongyang, and the basic tools to be able to get around and know where you're going in the country. So this was an accident, but I have stayed with it for a long time. So for whatever it's worth, that's my background. I want to talk a bit about the analytical foundations of this book, which might sound a bit arcane, but I think has some relevance for policymakers, for those of you that are engaged in policy. First of all, I argue in the foundation of this book that we have collectively, outside the DPRK, a knowledge base about the DPRK in quantitative and qualitative terms if we want to go and look for it. This is today. We didn't have this 12 years ago, or we didn't have this when I was working in the first, around about the time of the first nuclear crisis, 92, 93. We didn't have raw data. We didn't even know the names of the counties in the DPRK. We only had the South Korean names for the counties. And when we were putting together in 1998 with UNICEF an analysis of what was going on in each county on women and children, we started off with the South Korean names for the counties, and we had to go through and at that very basic level just reorganize the framework for the geographical framework, and then do some common romanization of names, which the North Koreans were happy with, and which we then used as the foundation for thinking about, for standardizing across the international organizations. So we didn't know very much about what was going on internally in the DPRK 10 or 12 years ago. We had some trade statistics because of partners who traded with the DPRK. And another reason we didn't know very much, partly because the DPRK didn't want us to know very much, but also because the major trading and political partners of the DPRK had been, until very recently, communist countries who were also closed, who, although they had interactions with the DPRK, didn't themselves publish data, information, analysis, didn't have strong social science traditions, Eastern Europe, China, former Soviet Union. So there was no natural way in which information would come out of those relationships as well. A closed loop. South Korea, of course, at that time had next to no relations with North Korea, and certainly not at the societal level. Now, the situation today is vastly, vastly different. If you go on the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Assistance, UNOCHA's website, which is freely available, and you click on DPRK, you will literally find thousands of reports from various organizations, whether it's the government of Australia, the government of the United States, the State Department, the Food and Agriculture Organization, press releases, NGOs, going back as far as 1994, 1995. Some of these don't tell you very much, and some of them are extraordinarily scientifically organized, factually based, systematically thought through, and rigorous analysis, particularly on agriculture. So once you start trawling through all this stuff, you find that there are some areas we actually know quite a lot about, and that's just based on what you can find in these public sources. We're not even talking here about the interviewing all the hundreds of thousands of people that have been through the DPRK in the past 10 years now. You can find that you can make some assessment, particularly if you're a trained analyst, as to what's good and what isn't in terms of the data. But nevertheless, it's available. If you want a map on the DPRK showing what's happening in the counties, you click onto the DPRK maps on this website and find out what's there. So some sectors there's better information than others. Of course, I don't think anybody knows what's going on in the top political leadership outside, and that's guesswork. I mean, who knows that? Personally, I'm not a Kremlinologist. I don't watch who's standing next to Kim Jong-il on the platforms at army parades. I'm not interested in this stuff, although I know some people are. I'm talking about the socio-economy. There's data on this stuff. And so why is this important for those of us that try to do scholarship on the DPRK? And the first is because it tells us, trawling through all this stuff, is that we can make some assessments about the things that we can know about, but also the things that we don't know about. We can have a little bit about of modesty about what we can say, what we can say, and we can be a little bit qualified about what we can say. Secondly, if we at all aim to produce knowledge as opposed to opinion or speculation, we can try to make knowledge-based claims based on the over-use of sources. By that I mean, if you're a scientist, a medical scientist, for instance, or a biologist, and you produce a paper in Nature or Science, the reason you put footnotes and references is so that any scientist can go to your article and can replicate your results given the footnotes that you give and the sources that you give and the argumentation that you've made. Science is about replicability. It's the same with social science. If you give the foundations, your sources where you've got your information and show your argumentation, somebody going to your work should be able, they may not agree with you, but they should be able to follow the process of your argumentation and know how you've come to those conclusions. And if we can do that with the DPRK, as we do with other countries, we can show the gaps in our knowledge, but we can also do away with this need, which you still see, for basing so-called factual conclusions on anonymous interviewees, for instance, which you see in a lot of the literature. Now, I'm not saying anonymous interviewees can't be useful. They can be. They can point you to knowledge, but they can't give you a foundation for making knowledge claims about the DPRK. So we can separate, I think now, and this is what this book is about, I hope, we can separate our opinion from scholarship. We can also respect the military in their planning when they use worst-case scenarios for planning purposes, but at the same time, we can say, as scholars or as those of us that are interested in factual understandings of the DPRK, that worst-case scenarios are just that. You know, military planners, if they're faced with an opaque society, it's incumbent upon them to have worst-case scenarios. Because if they don't know what's going to happen, they should have worst-case scenarios for national defence. But that doesn't mean to say that those worst-case scenarios represent the factual foundation which we can talk about with certainty in terms of what's going on in the DPRK. For instance, a classic example is the issue of dual-use chemical factories in the DPRK, which are there for agricultural purposes because the DPRK is a highly energy-intensive agricultural state, but could also be used for dual-use chemical weapons. And so there's speculation by the military that these are for dual use, and you have wargaming built on this, which is perfectly appropriate. But it's one step from that to go to another step to say that this is the actuality, which is again what we find, and I don't think we need to do this. And the final thing that I hope underpins my book is the fact to say, as we all know, as we know of our own society, of our own lives, that the DPRK, like any other society, changes. Societies change over time. Maybe the government doesn't change very much, but societies change over time. So we should be trying to chart change. So it's no good if you go to a piece of work and they say to you, ah, so-and-so did this in 1994, and therefore the DPRK is this. It doesn't work. The DPRK, like any other society, is a society in change. And so the next thing I argue is that we can get knowledge about the DPRK, some things we can and some things we can't. And if that's true, that we can have a reasonable knowledge base about the DPRK, that means that some things, I think, we can say are intelligible. I mean, that maybe, yes, I think I'd want to argue that there's an intelligibility to the DPRK. It's not mad, it's not irrational, it's not susceptible to the sorts of normal analysis that you would do of any other country. So, for example, on North Korean foreign policy, I think it's very straightforward what North Korean foreign policy is right now, particularly in relationship to the United States. North Korean analysis is of the United States is that it's concerned, to say the least, maybe frightened at best, about United States, the intentions of the United States, not overall, not this wonderful disaggregated society which is the United States, but the United States government at the moment. It's concerned about the intentions the United States government has towards it. It is also concerned about economic redevelopment of its country, and it's also concerned about political regime maintenance. Now, we might not agree that regime maintenance is a good thing, but nevertheless, that's a different matter from not understanding that that's their concern at the government level. Regime maintenance, concern about US military political intentions, and concern with economic redevelopment. What they see in terms of US intentions are that there are three states which are of primary concern to the United States in its foreign policy and have been throughout the period of the two Bush administrations: Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. Now, Iraq, of course, there's a war going on. Iran, there's quite a few bellicose statements taking place. And North Korea, we still have the statements that have taken place, which I think are not just at the level of rhetoric. And, of course, we do know ourselves that there's been divisions in the Bush administrations. But we do know that North Korea continues to be a major, in North Korea's terms, target country for the U.S. administration. The North Korea also says, look, you have the United States troops that are being pulled back, have been pulled back from the border, the South Korea-North Korea border. It looks like the Secretary of Defense's plan is to take U.S. troops virtually out of South Korea altogether. And this will mean that there's no tripwire in Korea, as we had in Europe throughout the Cold War. U.S. troops were stationed in Europe, and it was a crude calculation on behalf of European governments that if the Soviet Union or anybody came into Western Europe and U.S. troops were involved, then this would automatically involve the United States in war and protecting Europe. And the North Koreans say if the troops are come out of U.S. troops come out of South Korea, because they're in the paradoxical position now of wanting U.S. troops to stay in South Korea, if they come out of South Korea, this means that the U.S. is preparing for some sort of military strike or surgical strike. And that's their view. On the economy, again, in terms of intelligibility, we know, and there's been a lot of research, very excellent research done, particularly by South Korean economists now, that up to 1 million people died over a period of time in the mid-1990s from severe malnutrition and famine. The question we might want to ask ourselves, though, for those of us analysing the DPRK, apart from the terrible tragedy of the famine, is how did the 22 million people that did not die, how did they survive? Because the state didn't help them survive. The state couldn't cope, couldn't deliver food, couldn't redistribute food, still can't, and couldn't distribute medical goods. And they survived because they spontaneously created a market economy. They bartered, they swapped, they used contacts, particularly the middle-level party officials throughout the country, and they created a market economy. This has nothing to do with the government saying, let's have economic reforms. They created a primitive market economy. So much so that the government, which tried to ignore it at first, the central government tried to roll it back in the late 1990s, gave up by the early 2000s. And so by 2002, these so-called economic reforms that have been we've heard all about in the West were a lag factor behind what the population had done, and an effort to control what the population had done, rather than a lead factor in taking the way forward on the economy. What also happened as a result of these massive changes with the state not providing anymore was that you had a new class system developed in the DPRK. The party officials, because it's so massive, there's millions of them, and the security officials at the local level were the ones that were the most desperate if they were away from Pyongyang, because if they, unless they had access to relatives with food, or unless they had access to foreigners, these white-collar workers no longer had access to food when the state couldn't provide, and no longer had access to stable income. And it's this level, this middle level outside Pyongyang, that started to engage in petty commerce and to turn a blind eye at the local level when local people were engaging in petty commerce, either over the border into China or elsewhere. And so you had changed class relations in the DPRK, and the most vivid example is that the industrial working class of the Northeast, formerly the most privileged, with the most relatively most income, the most food, these people became the most underprivileged. The economic redevelopment, such as it is, has taken place on the west coast from Sinuiju down to Pyongyang to Nampo and Kaesong. It's not taken place on the east coast. It's mountainous up there. It's freezing. Can go to minus 40 in the winter. It's hard scrabble land, not suitable for agriculture. These are the people, the formerly privileged. They had proportionally more votes in the central committees of the party that you see as the refugees and migrants up to China. And all these formerly privileged people are now the most underprivileged people in the DPRK. So you see this social, massive socioeconomic change that has taken place in the DPRK. Massive. You see the old elite still there around Kim Jong-il and his family, but a new elite, which doesn't share the Swiss bank accounts and the real wealth, but this commercial elite of those that have been able to take advantage of these new market opportunities, that might still live in Pyongyang in these tall apartment blocks. They might still have no electricity half the time and have to carry up their water and have no sewage system that works, but they can go and buy a second-hand Japanese car from these market commercial links, or they might be able to get a video or a TV, and so they've got electrical goods, and it's very ostentatious. You'll see this if you travel around the country. You've got this new small nouveau riche being created. It's a new class relations of production. So now, and this is what the book talks about, this whole transition, how that happens over a period of time, and it's footnoted. Now what you have in the 2000s in North Korea is this decentralised and fragmented society in the DPRK. I think it's an open question as to how much political control the government has outside Pyongyang, which is one of the reasons you see lots of crime and apartment blocks anywhere in the little urban areas. The bottom floors always have their grills on the first floors because of fear of crime. You've seen the social welfare net decimated. If you want medicines now, you buy them. They're not available in the hospitals or the clinics. And what is available is allocated at the county level. It depends on what comes into the county level. Food emergency rations, those decisions are taking place at the county level. And so if you've had a good crop in the county and you manage to redistribute to the elderly, then you might get some. But actually, families are expected to look after the elderly these days. So if you're a single elderly person without family, you're in trouble. You've got a society of petty traders, and you've got these cross-cutting cleavages of inequality now, and it can depend on where you live, geography, but it's not simply by province, it can be within a province. So if you're in North Pyongyang, which is the province to the northwest of Pyongyang, and you live in a coal mining province, and it's not much arable land, you might be in trouble for food, whereas next door, in a coal mining county, in a county next door, you might have food being grown there, and it'll be distributed around the cooperative farm, and you'll be better off. So you're divided by geography, gender. Mothers are giving food to their children, which you find in every country. Mothers, all the nutrition surveys are finding are still malnourished, even though young children, their nutrition levels are getting better. By age, if you're elderly and you don't have support, you're going to be in trouble. And by occupation, if you're and it's not just whether you're a senior party official anymore or a lower level worker in a restaurant, for instance, if you're a senior party official but you don't come into contact with foreigners, you're not going to have access to hard currency, or you're not going to have access to the things that foreigners are going to have access to, you still might be in trouble in terms of finding food for your family. Whereas if you're a restaurant worker in Nampo or in Chongjin or a dock worker and you have access to hard currency and the ships that are coming in, then you will be better off than many more senior party level people. And that's very different than it was even in 1998. In 1998, when I lived there, if you tried to give hard currency to people who worked in your house or worked in the restaurants, they couldn't take it off you because they couldn't spend it, because they'd be in trouble, they'd be picked on. But now it's accepted that if you get hard currency, you can have it and you can spend it at all levels of societies. And in some ways, I was trying to think of comparators here. North Korea now, I think, is, well, in some ways it's like the Latin American authoritarian dictatorships of the 1980s. You know, you've got authoritarian political control, you've got the military in control, you've got business which is allowed to do exactly what it likes as long as it doesn't have any dissent with the state, and you have no social welfare net, and you have the rise of corruption. The difference in Latin America, of course, is that you have the influence of the churches and some elements of civil society. So that's not a fantastic comparison. But another comparison, which probably has more mileage in it, is the former non-oil-producing states of the former Soviet Union. And some work that I'd like to do is to think about, because if you look at parts of Russia, for instance, the eastern parts of Russia, where today you see huge rises in mortality, huge rises in the number of orphans, huge rises in poverty, still the authoritarian control of local governors who were, you know, democracy might be running riot in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but it isn't out in the hinterlands. And so I think it's these sorts of areas of Russia that we might find, and no history of civil society over the last 40, 50 years. So it's maybe these sorts of areas that we should be looking for comparators to. So that's the foundations of my book, before I get on to the book. I'm arguing that we can study this country as we can study others. We should be a bit modest about claiming what we can know and what we can't know, but in that perspective, we can chart change. So my research questions for this book were, what changed over the past 15 years in North Korean society? I couldn't figure out what was happening politically at the top. I've got pretty good friends now in the North Korean Ministry of Foreign Trade, and so I know the people in the Ministry of Foreign Trade hate the Ministry of Foreign people in the Ministry of Foreign Relations, and vice versa. Maybe that's too strong, but there's an ongoing conflict, and there's conflict within these ministries. But that's what you'd expect in any bureaucracy. It happens in my country, it happens in the States. But I don't know much about that. But certainly you can chart change within the society in terms of what's happening socially and economically. Secondly, I wanted to know, given these very big changes in the socio-economy, this move to marketization without liberalization, how did this affect North Korean foreign policy? Was foreign policy affected by this? And thirdly, I wanted to know, how did the influx of humanitarian organizations into the country in the from the mid-1990s onwards, the resident UN organizations as well as the resident NGOs, plus the coming and going of hundreds of NGOs from all over the world, staying for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, travelling around the country, Americans, everybody apart from Japanese going into the country. How did that have an impact on the society and the politics, if at all? Did it make any difference in terms of the ideas that were being imported and that were being implemented through the ways that the North Korean government had to work with the humanitarian organizations? And if all of that, and if we could come to any conclusions about that, how does this knowledge that I thought we could find, how does it help policymakers from the outside who have to deal with the North Koreans, which is still, of course, a relatively opaque country? And so on the basis of understanding more, perhaps we can have better policy. So that was the theme of my book. And the analytical theme was that we can't simply separate out nuclear and missiles issues from human rights and humanitarian issues, that we have to have some way, an analytical framework that can understand that in security terms for the individual human being in the DPRK, human rights are important, social development is important, including basically the right to food, and also national security issues are important for them. One of the sort of more arcane things I did, which I won't go into today, was to try to provide an analytical framework which could allow what in our business, the jargon we call human security issues, to be looked in tandem with national security issues. So that provided the framework. Now, I can't say that in terms of analytically that I probably did anything new in terms of political analysis, in terms of things that are not done in other countries. In many ways, it's an old-fashioned domestic politics approach. I'm arguing that you need to look at what's happening domestically in order to be able to understand the foreign policy of a country. So I wouldn't say it's a very elaborate ambition, Perhaps what, again, is of most immediate interest is the fact that in three of the chapters I've charted, and I'm going to finish here, I've charted social and economic change in the DPRK from the period of the Kim Il-sung government through to the period of transition through the 1990s to the end of the 1990s, when the government actually, I think, really didn't know which way it was going to go, to the 2000s when it became much more confident that it had things under control. And if it's worth anything, I think the late 1990s, the early 2000s, were a missed opportunity for the West, actually, because there were so many incentives for the North Korean government to do a deal, which they would have done. They would have done a deal. I mean, the Clinton visit that was supposed to take place in December 2000, of course, we can all say it might have done this or it might not have done that. The critics of that visit were that all the ends weren't tied up before Clinton was going to go. But nevertheless, in retrospect, I think that this was a period when deals could have been done. And now the national security framework for the North Korean government is so strong, because they do think that if their vulnerabilities are exposed, and they have many vulnerabilities, then this will provide an excuse for attack, that it's difficult to see how in the short term that there will be future, the same sorts of windows of opportunity as there were in the late 1990s for foreign policy interlocutors. Ambassador Gregg has asked me to show a few pictures. I don't know if I've got time to do a few. I'm going to show a few slides from North Korea. These are not mine. They were taken by a German photographer whose permission I don't have, but I think they're in the public domain because they were paid for by public German money. So if he's here, apologies. And they've been out all around with the World Food Programme, and they give some idea of the conditions in which people are living. He had completely free access wherever he went, whether East Coast and the West Coast. I have pictures, but they're not as good as this sort of professional photographer. One of the things I think we forget is that North Korea is in Northeast Asia, which is on the whole rather prosperous, including the eastern sides of China. But North Korea today should be thought of more as a poor country, more like the countries of Southeast Asia. There's huge poverty, there's inequality, the malnutrition rates are the same as in Laos and Indonesia and parts of India. And that's the picture of the country that we get, I think, from these photographs.
Hazel, as you get ready to show these pictures, what has been the effect on attitudinal views of the regime? What has been the cross-cutting and the dispossessing of the previous elite? What is the possibility of real unrest, and how strong is the control of the Kim Jong-il group over the rest of North Korea?
From talking to North Korean colleagues and friends and from interviewing people throughout the country, in translation, but people are very free, actually, in terms of talking, as long they don't criticise Kim Il-sung or Kim Jong-il, but they're people are fairly willing, not everywhere, but quite often are willing to talk, especially if you go back again and again and again. There's nobody, and people are not stupid either. You know, people have been living for 15 years in poverty, and there is nobody, let me tell you, that believes that they're living in a socialist paradise. And they blame, they may not blame their leader directly, but often they will say it's the fault of the officials. Which is a way of talking about aspects of the government. So I think the sort of roundabout answer to this is that there's still a chronic food shortage. So the top priority is to get food to keep you and your family throughout the lean season, even if you're an urban worker or a teacher or a professional, especially if you're them, because you don't have access to food. So my feeling is that the questions for political discussion in terms of for potential political organisation are simply not asked by most people, because their priority simply is to get enough food. There's still chronic food shortages in North Korea. It's not a question simply of distribution of food going to the wrong groups. There's still chronic food shortages. And also, there is no way in the country that political debate can take place outside the military. So if there is dissent or opposition or a different perspective, that will be taking place in the military. And honestly, I don't have that access to even make a speculation as to what that debate might be, is the honest answer. But at the level of the people, nobody... It's just hardship. It's basically constant hardship. At the level of the technocrats, the people that I deal with, the Ministry of Foreign Trade, their attitude is, they say to me, well, you know what our country's like, Hazel. I mean, they're just sort of resigned, well, when change takes place, it will be better, but in the meantime, we've got to put up with it. I'm sorry, it's not sophisticated.
No, that's important.
Okay. Pictures.
We can't get the slideshow operating, so I'm going to have to show them one by one. Sorry. But let's see what we can do. I'm sure there's something a little more technically better than this to me. These were taken about 3 years ago.
Can you turn off the light, please?
Is anybody... Can we get these to a bit of a bigger... No. There was a gentleman here before that knew how to do it, so he got them on a photo.
Well, they're as big as they can be now.
Okay, that was... I think this is a fairly... It's only a little boy, but it's a fairly typical picture of... even in Pyongyang, you know, people say that Pyongyang's a Potemkin village, Potemkin city. But you go to the neighbourhoods behind where I was living, for instance, you've got these little wooden shacks where people are living in unmade-up roads. Of course, there are the apartment blocks in Pyongyang, but there are also places like this as well. This is a fairly typical house. You know, you've got the two pictures of... Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and a gentleman here who was a recipient of the German food aid. That's why he's in the picture in his house. And you'll notice the wallpaper, which is probably the colour it is because everybody smokes in the country. Well, men. Women don't smoke. At least I have seen some women in the army smoking, but even they tend to do it sort of round the corner rather than in public.
The tiger painting there seems to be rather different from the ones you see in South Korea, which are usually humorous. This looks more like the Japanese version of very fierce tiger. Is that typical, or is that just...
That's a very typical painting, yeah. In fact, in their art, they're only allowed to paint certain things in their art, and so they tend to be repeated in terms of the scenes. They're not allowed to paint nude bodies, for instance, and they're not allowed to paint abstract pictures. And that's, you can't see it here, but that's a picture of Kim Jong-il on the left. Gentleman and his wife.
A farmer?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. A little plot, but I don't think so. I'm just picking some of these at random, because I can't get the technology to... That's a little plot. We felt that was pretty staged, but I mean, I always feel sorry for people when they come in and every foreigner wants to take photos of somebody in their homes. I always think it's rather intrusive myself, but there you are. Including myself, of course. It's this is in one of the many nurseries. One of the things that's happening now in the nurseries is that the women... In nurseries and in primary school, the staff is almost 100% women. But because women are also expected in the DPRK, even though there's a very high participation of women in the workforce, to be the ones to go and look for food and to look after the children, since the famine started and everybody's got to run around looking for food all the time, the workforce has been decimated in the institutions for children, because women have been spending very large proportions of their time outside the workplace. And this is looking for food and looking for medicines and looking after sick children. And this has had an enormous impact, I think, on the ability of the state to socialise children in the old Kim Il-sung ways. I mean, you go to the nursery and the staff have just about got enough time to keep the children clean, not to do much else and to maybe feed them at the nursery level. I think it probably will have an impact long-term on their literacy levels as well, because literacy is a very literate and numerate country everywhere. The poorest area, in the poorest, most remote area, people are literate. But I think it probably will have an effect medium to long-term on the literacy level, the fact that schools have had to be run down. So I always used to think it was quite a good thing when the people did come round as well, because probably they got a bit more food than on the other days when it was probably shared around a bit. What we found was when we were working in the institutions, was that they gave less than the ration and they stored more, because they were very, most of the institution directors knew that the aid would only come very sporadically. For instance, even when WFP had a huge aid program in 2000 to 2001, it still couldn't feed every nursery and every orphanage and every school every day, every month. So it was a rational strategy in many ways to store stuff. But I think when the visitors came round, then they got a full bowl, and here you see the rice and the soup that this little guy's got. Where am I? This is still an important form of transport. Actually, this is probably an advanced form of transport, because a lot of it is just on people's backs still in the country. And I know I haven't been in the remotest parts of South Korea, although I spent a bit of time on farms in South Korea in December. And I guess in South Korea anymore, you don't see the ladies walking around with the very bent backs from having carried loads on their backs all through their youth. But you see that everywhere in North Korea. And it's still the case that that men and women carry loads on their backs because there isn't the transport. More of these children in there. This is in Pyongyang. And you can see that they're mending the road. But what's interesting about this is the level of technology. And it's the same, you know, that they've got shovels here. But you can see these guys, it's the middle of the winter, and some of them are working without gloves. And there's a load of people, men and women, hanging around. And I think what they do is they can... Well, I don't think, I know it. What they do is they conserve energy. You might see 20 or 30 people in the cold, in the winter, working like this, but always, you know, about half are standing still or having a chat. And it's a way to conserve energy, because if you're out there in the cold and you're using up all these calories and you haven't got this very high level of technology, you're using physical work, and you're not getting fed very much, well, this is a sensible way to do it, is to, you know, have a few people working at a time. And that seems to be the way that people manage to survive with the often very heavy physical work that they have to do. And that's professionals as well. They have to go out and do their fair share. It's more of the same. All the women, you see, the women doing the work and the guys hanging around telling them what to do. Doesn't change, does it, in most societies? With the greatest respect. There's Pyongyang. Just as an anecdote, that hotel there, the Rugyong Hotel in the middle, I don't know if I should tell you, it's a bit personal, but my partner, who I met in Mount Myohang in 1990 from former Yugoslavia, was working on that hotel in 1990. He was sent by the Yugoslav government, which then had friendly relations with the DPRK, and his institute. He's a civil engineer, to work on the structural, to do tests as to whether the structure was sound of the hotel. And he said they did these tests, and it's a very structurally sound building, which is probably one of the reasons they can't demolish it. But he said one of the interesting things was that the people he was working with were doing fantastic computations, but they could never see a computer. And that was in 1990. And he thinks that they did it all manually. They always say, oh, we'll come back with the computer printouts, but all the computations were done, he thinks, manually. It was a prestige project. The Yugoslav government got paid very large amounts of hard currency for doing that.
Is it true that it's 100 and some stories and it's somewhat out of line?
No, it's not true. It's not true.
How many stories is it?
I don't know how many stories it is, but it's not out of line. It's structurally okay.
Why is it never open?
Because it would have been very expensive to build all the... they had to. The next step was to put glass, and it's a strange shape. But all the internal fitments would have been very expensive. At the same time that was being built, the Yangak Do was being built by a French construction company, and that took some time once it had been built to open, because they had to get investment to do all the insides of it.
At a hotel,
the Yangak Do Hotel, yeah, on a little island in Pyongyang, and it was built in the competition for the time to be the highest concrete building in the world. And it was a time when Kuala Lumpur and Shanghai and everybody else wanted to have the highest buildings in the world. So it was part of that discussion about having high buildings in East Asia. They couldn't afford to do all to finish it off. But it's structurally sound. It's if anybody ever does end up staying in it. This is Pyongyang. I have to say, for those who have not been to the DPRK, and I know many of you have, it's a very beautiful country. It's mountains and beaches, and it's a beautiful, beautiful country. I'm trying to find something of interest here. This is what you see the kids doing in the winter. They haven't got any... they don't get toys or anything, so they literally slide along the roads. And often they'll get a plank, a piece of wood, and they'll slide along on that. They're endlessly inventive. And these little guys are good. Well, they've got gloves on, and that isn't always the same, but he hasn't got a hat on, so he's probably pretty cold. And just canvas sneakers, which is very common. Tell me when to stop. I think this is in Wan San. I think this is the orphanage in Wan San.
But this is much better than what you saw at the depths of the famine.
In 2001, which was the last time I went in an orphanage in Pangyo in southwest, in Kangwon in southwest DPRK, you could still see pockets of very severe malnutrition. I mean, I think there must be still cases where they're bringing children in, but if you look at the nutrition survey, and that shows that that's still happening, but it's not as, nobody's saying it's as widespread as it was, but there's certainly areas, I think, in the remote areas where they're not getting enough food, and where the children are being brought to the authorities too late, and they're not having enough food.
Why don't we open it up for questions now? Thank you very much, and those pictures are very, very good, I must say. Yeah. Yes, Colonel?
Hi, this is Mark Buckman from the Council on Foreign Relations.
The serving colonel.
In the at the beginning of your talk, you talked about the knowledge base today being that much greater, but you also talked about some anonymous sources. I was wondering if you were familiar with a work called Hidden Gulag, which uses a lot of anonymous sources, anonymous interviews, and if you are familiar with that, can you comment on your opinion? Did you see any evidence of that? Does it strike you as credible, or is it just one of those things that's out there that you just can't ascertain the validity of?
I'm not sure. Is this the one done by David Hawke? Okay. I've read quite a lot of the literature on prison camps in DPRK, and on the stories that have got on the web. I don't write about. I mentioned the prisons in my book, and I mentioned the coercion as used in DPRK. I haven't written about it in some detail because I can't find proper sources, and so what I would say would be on the. Sorry. Well, I haven't written about it in some detail, although I've mentioned it because of the source issue for me. But of the material I've seen, most of it is based on defector interviews. Now, defector interviews during the before the rapprochement between South Korea and North Korea were hopelessly distorted as uses of sources. You know, the South Korean intelligence agencies got hold of them, and used the material for what they perceived as South Korean national interests. It's not the same now, actually. So the way that defector interviews take place now in South Korea, and I work with some of the people that are doing them, they do try to consciously sift through and match the information that's coming out against other information that they know. So I think that what we can get out now is probably more valuable. It's the generalizability issue as well can you generalise from somebody's experiences in County X? Not that it's you should have to generalise. If somebody in County X has had a terrible experience, then that's bad enough by itself. What about the literature? I'm suspicious of a literature which uses incidents of 1987 to talk about an unchanging DPRK and not point out. And I'm suspicious of literature that doesn't acknowledge the problems with using defector interviews. I'm not saying that it can't be used. I'm saying that if we have a book that says North Korea is like this and uses defector interviews but doesn't point out the problems with using defector interviews, then I've got a problem with it because that book seems to want to claim more than it can. On the other hand, we do know a fair bit about the structure of the system of the DPRK in terms of its prison system because it inherited it from the Japanese system. And so under Japanese colonialism, when it was, you know, it was an offence to think bad thoughts about the regime, that was just transferred lock, stock and barrel, more or less, into the DPRK way of thinking about things. We do know that they in terms of punishments, when dissent took place, the whole family was sent off to the countryside. So we do know that the structure of the system. And we do know that in the famine period in the mid-1990s, that if you were in the poorest paid jobs and if you were in a county that didn't have access to food, or if you were not very lucky, you probably didn't have access to food. And that would probably include people who work who in prisons and who work in these big labour, re-education through labour camps. So they must have been in a very, very bad state indeed. So I think all those things we can say, we can make some good analysis of. Whether the questions that the Gulag literature raises, is the North Korean government so evil that it's deliberately starving its people, tearing out fetuses from abdomens, and all the rest of the things that this literature says? It may be so. It may be so, but it's hard to get really credible work on this. So I think that I can't really say much more than that. But I think this is not a. If you fall foul of the state, this is not a pleasant society to live in. Dissenters will be punished, to say the least. And if you're in prison in the DPRK, it's not going to be a pleasant place to be. And it doesn't make it any better, but I would imagine neither would any prison in any of Southeast Asia or even South Korea a few years ago be a nice place to be. I think that the analogies are there. That doesn't make it better. But again, we don't have to look very far to see that there are international comparators there. I think the question might be for those of us that accept that that there are prison conditions are tough in other places, is are North Korean prison conditions so much beyond the pale that we can literally say they're inhumane in by any standard? And I have to say that I don't know. I'm sorry if that's a roundabout.
Let me ask, what are the attitudes towards South Korea? Are they curious about it, and do they have any sense of how far behind South Korea, North Korea has fallen?
I think the technocrats who come into contact with the now thousands of South Koreans that come have come in and out of the country, not just at Kumgansan, not the million or so that have come into Kumgansan in the tourist project in the southeast, but the thousands that have come in through NGOs, through businesses, through governments, through exchanges of one sort or the other, and they're literally thousands now. Of course, they speak the same language. So they have conversations, and so they are fully aware that South Korea is an advanced capitalist and democratic state. And many of them, at least the people that I come into contact with, particularly in the Ministry of Foreign Trade, do not say we want to be South Korea, but they do say we want to be an economically prosperous and developed country, and South Korea is that. I've always been surprised from the people I've come into contact and worked with in the Foreign Ministry, in the Ministry of Foreign Trade, and the level of the drivers when you're driving for 3 weeks and I'm working with my North Korean colleague, who's sometimes a friend plus a driver, and you're living and working and breathing for 3 weeks with them, so you have some conversations, that there really isn't a big surprise or shock about South Korea. So no, I haven't come across that at all. But for the ordinary people who don't, particularly in the north, they're more likely to have evidence of Chinese development, I think, than South Korean development, because there's an influx of Chinese traders, particularly in the northeast, but also elsewhere. And I think it's probably it's Chinese society that they're finding out more about, and that might be more of a surprise.
Okay. Yes, Roy.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. I'd like to thank you very much for the Korean Society sponsoring this very stimulating event, and was words coming up even from Philadelphia, I must tell you. Now, following that question you raised, Professor Smith, you mentioned talking about the profound changes taking place in North Korea. The question that I have to follow up, Don's question, is that have you seen any indication on the part of policymakers in Pyongyang, possibly sometime in the future, they may consider changing the constitution to eliminate DPRK's program to invade the South? This would have a tremendous impact to North-South relations, and it is yet to be done. And I think this is a very, very critical element. Thank you.
I have not, but in terms of now what is the norm in terms of North Korea's interaction with South Korea, and given that North Korea is, again, this might go against the grain, a very pragmatic government, the North Korean government is very pragmatic, I don't think that this would be an issue of
you
principle.
You say North Korea is
a pragmatic
government.
Okay. It's a pragmatic government. The words in the Constitution would not be an issue of principle as far as North Korea was concerned if there was going to be an even further development in the rapprochement that's already taken place between North and South Korea. And for what it's worth, my view on this is that, again, from the U.S. perspective, is that the U.S. may find itself trailing behind, as it did in 2000, if North and South Korea are shaking hands at Panmunjom and have a developed economic and political deal, say, next year or so, and then the constitution will be changed just like that, because it will follow on the deal that will have been done politically.
Thank you. Yes?
How much trade is there? Rick Templeton, Hilbert Pierce and Young. Rick Templeton, Hilbert Pierce and Young are small investment bankers. How much trade is there between North and South Korea, and what type of goods?
North Korea's total trade with its main trade partners are China and South Korea, and it runs a balance of trade deficit altogether, and that's made up from concessional support in one way or the other from China or South Korea. If I say the figures, I'll probably get it wrong, but it's about $2 billion, I think, $2 billion in total, the trade, exports and imports from North Korea. North Korea exports gold, ores, magnesium clinker, and again, believe it or not, seafood products. It also does some exporting of processed textiles. And it imports food on concessional terms from South Korea. Fertilizer also on concessional terms from South Korea. Technology where it can get hold of it. And some oil products for its agricultural industry. It's not mine. And other things, that basic goods it needs for its economy. So it's a low level of trade, and trade is expanding. Trade has decreased with Japan because of Japanese domestic policies have put constraints on Japanese trade with the DPRK over the last couple of years. But it's increased with, relatively speaking, with China and South Korea. In terms of the direction of your question, is there room for trade expansion in any area? Is that the direction of your question? Okay, what they're hoping to do is to expand the export of natural resources like ores. But the problem is, although they are willing to offer fantastic deals to anybody who's prepared to come in and mine their ores, the lack of economic infrastructure in terms of the equipment in the mines, for instance, the roads, the railways, electricity, basic water supplies, communication supplies, all this that would normally be provided by a government or something like the World Bank, means that it costs a lot. Transaction costs are high to get that stuff out of the ground and then get it exported. So the North Koreans are hoping, are trying to promote the export of their natural resources, but there are investment costs that would have to take place. They're also hoping to enter into the information technology industries, and they're working with South Korean firms and to try to do joint development in information technology, like animated cartoons and videos and this sort of thing.
In August of 2004, Fred and I ran into two gold miners in Pyongyang, one from Australia, the other from Malaysia. They had been out and had visited a number of North Korean mines, said the potential for profitable mining was very high, but the equipment was lousy, as Hazel said. There was a report recently on investment by foreigners in North Korea last year, and one company, I do not know what country it came from, had taken out $2 million in profit from a gold mine that it resuscitated, and had had no problem whatsoever exporting its profits from North Korea. Okay? Yes. If we can keep our hands up, we'll get the mic to the next questioner and save a little time. So who else wants to ask a question? Okay, in the back.
Thank you for the wonderful lecture. I'm from Japan's Kyodo News. How much is the U.S. economic sanctions hurting North Korea? Is it hurting more a government or the society? And my second question is, if Japan and North Korea normalizes relations and North Korea is provided with the compensation for the colonial rule, will it help transform the North Korean economy? Thank you.
I think they're both very good questions. Of course, North Korea argues that all its problems come about because of U.S. sanctions. My view is that they are almost irrelevant at this moment. And this is because other countries don't impose sanctions on the DPRK, more natural trading nations with the DPRK, China, for instance, South Korea, even the Europeans, the Southeast Asian nations. So everything that they could export, they can still export. Everything that they could import, short of the nuclear centrifuges, they can import if they had the money to buy them. Of course, it doesn't help because one of the reasons it doesn't help is because, given the US economic political approach, it means that North Korea can't become a member of the World Bank. Therefore, they are ineligible for Asian Development Bank funding and all the rest of it. So indirectly, of course, it doesn't help. But in terms of the short-term blockage of their trade opportunities, it's not an immediate problem because they don't have much to trade. And the things that they do need, they can get from elsewhere. So that's the first thing. Of course, the North Korean government wouldn't agree with this, with my interpretation. That's my interpretation. Japan, North Korea. And again, this is an issue for U.S. foreign policy. If there is a deal done between South and North Korea outside the six-party talks, And if Japan and China go along with this, and Russia goes along with it outside the six-party talks, and Japan, Mr. Koizumi, seems to want to normalise despite the domestic pressures on the abductees issues, and Japan says, well, we might not give you all the billions we're going to give you post a full settlement with the US, but in terms of a thought experiment, we'll give you just a couple of the billions we're going to give you. That will have an enormous impact on what the DPRK can and can't do, because it does have an economic plan. Maybe we won't agree. It does have an economic plan, and it would invest in certain sectors. This isn't a state that's completely fallen apart. It could invest in certain sectors, particularly if it was going to do that with South Korea, in terms of the expansion of the electricity grid, the building up of conventional power stations, never mind any other sorts of power stations, the resuscitation or the rebuilding or the building of a telecommunications network. All these sorts of things could be done fairly quickly, or they could start work on them fairly quickly. And so again, if there is either a semi-deal done outside the five-party talks, and Japan does decide to spend, all of you here will know that Japan is committed to giving the DPRK billions for I know it's not called reparations, but effectively reparations on the lines of the 1965 deal done with South Korea, then this will provide an enormous boost to the North Korean economy. The question is, given the current way of doing things, unless there's some change inside, this could entrench the very worst capitalist practices of, you know, corruption and non-accountability and all the sorts of things that South Korea's been struggling to get rid of and has more or less got rid of over the past few years. So there are problems if this money comes very quickly.
Yes.
Professor Smith, given the chronic food shortages, any thoughts on why at the end of 2005 the government of North Korea reduced the presence of NGOs and particularly food programming?
Okay, good question. Well, NGOs don't mainly provide food. They're sort of doing ancillary medical help, and so that's another story there, but some of them provide niche food, and they're tiny compared to what the UN organizations have been doing in terms of volumes of aid. So the World Food Programme we'll start with the World Food Programme. Why has the government asked the World Food Programme to leave? Well, the nutritional indicators for children have stabilised, and it's children where the most work has been done. I mean, the aid community, since it started getting involved in North Korea, has targeted children under 7 years old. The nutrition surveys done by the international community in conjunction with the government have measured the nutritional health of children and mothers. So it's that we've got the most data on. And the nutritional indicators of children show stabilisation in the 2004 at around the levels of nutritional status of children in Laos, Indonesia, and India, parts of India. So we no longer have a famine situation. WFP is set up to work in famines and severe food crises. And because North Korea gets food now bilaterally from China and South Korea, its harvest has grown a little bit, and because it's got commitments from China and South Korea that China and South Korea will not allow famine to take place again, it feels that it's not an emergency situation anymore, and therefore organisations that want to work with it should be working on development assistance. Now, so far, so good. There's an argument for this. What North Korea hasn't quite realised yet is that development assistance requires information-intensive interactions. So we've not yet got to that. But at one level, it's a very rational strategy. There isn't an emergency there anymore. Of course, if fertiliser assistance stopped from South Korea and food assistance stopped from the bilateral food assistance stop, we would be back to where we were before. Now, the next question is, and of course this is a question in DC, which I think is a little bit unfair. It's come from DC the last 2 days. Is South Korea all to blame, you know, for the WFP going out? And really, it's nonsense, because South Korea has maintained its food support to WFP on a very steady level over the past few years. Those that have been reducing their food support to WFP have been the United States, Japan, European Union and other governments, and that's caused the level of food to decrease to WFP. So WFP has had really less leverage. South Korean food has stayed constant. So that's a bit of a red herring. There is the other side of it, which is that you do have inequality in North Korea now because of the market coming to North Korea. You do have people that are fed up, even though they're struggling to just carry on. You do have people that have more information about the outside world. You do have people who realise that even in the military, you know, you might get fed if you're in the military, but all the privileges that you formerly had, like you could go on to a good education, you could get a good job if you went in the military, you had privileged access to the universities, all that doesn't mean anything, because unless you've got a bit of money in your hand and you go out and do a business, then having access to what the state can provide doesn't provide you with anything. So you've got room for dissent in the military, and you know, we've seen instances in Yen Bien in the border area with China where you've had soldiers going and robbing banks in Tumen, you know, armed soldiers, North Korean soldiers, because they're not very privileged. I mean, they've got enough to get by, but they're not rich and prosperous. And you see this nouveau riche growing up, which is just the same as any nouveau riche in any other country. It flaunts its wealth, you know, goes into the shops and buys, you know, 1,000 cigarettes and 10 bottles of whiskey, and then goes back to and consumes it visibly. So you've got all this happening, and clearly there's room for social dissent, if not political dissent. And, of course, one of the things that the North Korean government could be figuring is that if this is going to happen, and I do actually think that their security and political sway is less outside Pyongyang than it ever was, then they don't want foreigners seeing this. And foreign business coming in is not so much a problem, because foreign business usually doesn't share its observations with others because of commercial reasons. So I don't think they're too bothered about foreign businesses, or, you know, somebody might report back. But they are worried about the humanitarian agencies seeing anything, because it's the humanitarian agencies, after all, that are committed to reporting back. I mean, that's their, part of their raison d'etre. So there is something. I mean, I'm sure that all these factors have gone into this decision. So the next step is, when organisations do development assistance, are they going to really insist on an information-rich environment in order to do proper development assistance?
Let's sort of, in closing, pretend that you're Tony Blair and I'm George Bush.
Oh, no.
So I've called you in to say, Tony, we don't seem to be getting any place with North Korea. Based on what you know, what would you advise us to do that we're not doing now, or what would you advise us to do more of that we're already doing?
You know, I don't want to be flippant, but I'd have to say, George, you know, you never listen to me anyway. I said this to two of my friends who work in Congress yesterday, and I would, if I had any contact, what this needs from U.S. foreign policy is a gesture, a bold gesture from a Republican. And I would suggest that the ideal person to do it is Mr. Wolfowitz in the World Bank, because he's in with the crowd that counts, and he's now got a different mandate at the World Bank, and he will be wanting, I think, to do things and leave a mark behind. And like Mr. McNamara before him, he might want to leave a mark behind in contrast, he's a thinking person, to the sort of mark behind which he's known for. And if a bold gesture is going to take place, it's got to be seated in this country, in the political establishment, to take it with them. No good even Dr. Rice putting forward a bold, I can say this because I'm a foreigner, putting forward a bold gesture if Mr. Cheney's not coming with her. And so therefore, it has to be somebody who's going to carry a gesture which will involve tough negotiations. The North Koreans are pragmatic and they're tough, but they will do a deal. They still want a deal. I mean, Leon Siegel here knows more than anybody what the North Koreans will deal. And I think that the lessons that should have been learned from Leon's work should have been learned, and we wouldn't be having this discussion now if we'd learned those lessons. And that, in my view, is what the North Koreans will listen to. They're pragmatic, they want respect, but they also will do a deal.
Thank you very much. This has been superb. I encourage you to come up and harass Hazel with your questions, but thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
The opinions expressed at this forum do not necessarily reflect those of the Korea Society. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Quarterly. Memberships may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.
The proceeding was a production of the Korea Society. For more information on our programs, please visit www.koreasociety.org.